The leadership, particularly in Britain, France, Germany, Italy to an extent, seem to be quite content to be the vassals of the Western Empire. And I'm careful to say Western Empire because I don't like to call it the American Empire. And so Germany is imploding, which is supposed to be the economic engine of Europe. It's crashing. I don't know what the solution is, but I see that our leadership is obsessed with Russia and Ukraine. It's all Russia, Russia, Russia. Let's go to war. Let's spend a lot of money that we don't have on armaments. People are just gonna have to do without, healthcare and education and all these things. We're gonna cut that so we could put more money into military industrial complex, and we're gonna go to war. Also, news yesterday, Vladimir Putin has apparently stated that, and this is confirmed, that Israel is no longer interested in going to war against Iran, and they've requested that Moscow convey that message to the Iranian leadership and that they serve as a mediator.
Alex Craner, good afternoon or good evening to you, my friend. How are you?
Good afternoon, Andy. Good to join you. I'm doing well.
I hope you're doing
And
well. I really do. It's well, let's start with that. It's getting hot, meaning now hot over in Europe, where you're at. So let's start with Europe. Last time well, you've said this when we first started talking. I don't know if that was about a year ago, I want to say. Just really the implosion with Europe, and there are a lot of different points that could happen first. It looks triggers, if you would. It looks like France is a complete mess and it's continuing to disintegrate, and it looks like the UK is not far behind them. So, yeah, where's Europe been going? Are we looking at the implosion, really, what we've been talking about of Europe here?
Europe is going towards the place where it's going to have to reinvent itself. It's going to have to decide what it wants to be. Does it want to be like a club of Western empires' vassals, or do they want to be sovereign nations that deal in good faith constructively with other sovereign nations? At the moment, the leadership, particularly in Britain, France, Germany, Italy to an extent, seem to be quite content to be the vassals of the Western Empire. And I'm careful to say Western Empire because I don't like to call it the American Empire, even though that's what it, at first blush, that's what it looks like. I think that the Western Empire is a reincarnation of the British Empire with satellites that are on Wall Street in Paris, Berlin, Stockholm, Tokyo, and so forth. And then, through the banking institutions, they control the government, and the governments do their bidding and pretty much ignore or suppress the will of the people. And you can do that only for so long. Even the Soviet Union didn't manage to survive for longer than 70 years, even though they applied extremely harsh totalitarianism against their people, and they had very, very extensive support from Western countries. Again, American troops, Japanese troops, Czech, Polish, French troops, British troops. They were all there in the early 1920s after the Bolshevik Revolution to preserve the power there. Well, it doesn't matter, but what the point I'm trying to make is you can only suppress the will of the people for so long, and at some point, the thing cracks. And so you noted, well, France is a mess. I think that Macron will not be able to avoid announcing new parliamentary elections. When the elections are held, almost certainly the Front National is going to win and be in the position to form the next government. Almost certainly, Macron will do everything to prevent this from happening. And French people have had enough, you know, and they've already gotten cheated out of their election last summer. If Macron pulls that again, I don't know how it ends this time, you know, but, you know, as they say, if a peaceful revolution is not possible, then you only get a violent revolution. I think that Britain is moving in the same direction, but there's a difference, you know. I think that the French are very patriotic, and they don't have a royal family and all the pomp and circumstance that goes along with it. The British have the royal family, and I think that a large segment of the British population, I don't know how much it is, but they always defer to the royalty. They respect the institution. You know, instead of going out like the French, demonstrating and spraying their public officials' offices with manure, they are like writing letters to the king asking them to please suspend the parliament and have new elections.
Right.
You know, I think a lot of them don't realize yet that the king is part of the whole thing. The way they're getting screwed. He's an integral part of all that. And then also the Brits, I think that their ruling establishment has been preparing for this. They know that it's coming, which is why they have been so eager to import all these military age male illegal immigrants, because what they're going to try to do is pit the indigenous British population against these immigrants. They're going to have them, you know, beat the living daylights out of each other, and then they're going to crack down to make peace, right? And they're gonna maybe introduce a curfew and lockdowns, and they're gonna push forward with these 15-minute cities and digital ID and CBDCs, and you know the whole thing. They're going to try to take advantage of it. And well, we'll see how that'll go. I think that the British people are farther along the way, in terms of being demoralized, in terms of having surrendered and, you know, succumbing to just learned helplessness. And then you have Germans, which are, you know, another German industrial production cratered 4% in August, month on month,
Yeah, that's
not
crazy.
annual rate, month on, it's insane. And so Germany is imploding, which is supposed to be the, you know, the economic engine of Europe. It's crashing. I don't know what the solution is, but I see that our leadership is obsessed with Russia and Ukraine. It's all Russia, Russia, Russia. Let's go to war. Let's spend a lot of money that we don't have on armaments. People are just going to have to do without, you know, healthcare and education and all these things. We're going to cut that so we could put more money into a military industrial complex, and we're going to go to war. Well, you know, the people don't want to have anything to do with all this. You know, they're going to vote for alternative parties. They're going to vote for sovereigntist movements, you know, like AfD in Germany and so forth. If the ruling establishments don't allow for a peaceful transfer of power, for people to elect new governments in order to change course, then you're going to have social uprising. Possibly civil wars. But I think that these civil wars would probably be Well, I don't know, it's not possible to even predict this, but the situation is very uneven because the let's call them the elites, which they're not elites, they're just freaking parasites. These groups who want war, who want keep the status quo, are a very small group and a narrow one, and I think that it's becoming more narrow by the day. Whereas the mass of people who want a change in course is large and growing ever larger. So I don't know how you have a civil war there. Maybe you just have a revolution. But I think that, if they don't allow for fair elections and a peaceful transfer of power, then they're going to get a revolution. And I think that right now there's no sign that they will just quietly go into the night and yield to the people.
There is no sign, especially you brought up Germany, and we talked about this last time, and it was only that you were on, it was only a few weeks ago, or and again, I want to say, I hope I get this right, is seven politicians from the opposing party, and I don't know what the party, I can't get the party's name right, but they mysteriously died. And then you came out with, I want to say it was an IMF bailout of Germany just in the last week. And then again, further indicating implosion, if you would. And that can't serve any good, getting however big it was alone from the IMF. That would just really further enslave the people. Correct me if I'm wrong. I just don't see a way out of this for those three countries, if you would. But you bring up something interesting. And it's really about the financial, the empire, if you would, the banking system, if you would. It seems like that word is getting out, if you would. And I guess what I'm trying to get at, what does that look like with the word getting out? And but they still want to maintain power. I mean, yeah, what does that look? And then you got gold at $4,000 an ounce, US dollars.
I'm not sure what it looks like, but I think that the awareness that we need to overhaul the financial system, that we need a different new monetary system that's not based on fraud. I think
Right.
that that awareness is spreading, and that's a very good thing. Now, how does that work out exactly? I'm not sure, because it's still, the people who control the current monetary system also hold the levers of power.
Right.
And I think that they hold the most important levers of power because you have this question. I mean, the world is drowning in unpayable debts. And then sometimes people say, like, well, who do we owe this debt to? And then there was like this Irish comedian. I forget his name now, but it was part of his skit. He said, like, well, why don't we find out who we owe this debt to? We kill the bastards and then we all relax. And that was meant to be a joke. But it's a.
It's a joke, but there's just some a lot of humor in
But it actually makes a very important point
that.
because. If the debts are unpayable, if they're suffocating the advanced developed economies collectively, if they're keeping people oppressed, living at a lesser level of prosperity than they otherwise would, and I mean, it's not lesser, it's like dramatically reduced for the debt services and all this. Well then, and we are supposedly democratic societies. Then I think it would be legitimate that people say, like, well, wait a minute, we're spending a huge chunk of our GDP on debt servicing. Why don't we just renegotiate that? Because, they're happy to renegotiate our pensions and our healthcare and everything else in the collective contract. Why are all these debts not up for renegotiation? So I think if you have truly democratic institutions of government, the government could say, like, okay, bondholders, we need to talk and we need to renegotiate this. You need to get a haircut. We need to reduce interest rates on all this, and then we can all get along together and everybody can be happy. But that never ever happens.
Right.
Why does that never ever happen? Well, obviously because the people who own all the debts also control, also have the monopoly on violence, you know, on so if somebody actually tried to move against them in any substantial way, they have many ways to destroy them, you know, as Chucky Schumer would say, they have six ways from Sunday to get back at you. And you know, that can be just simply uploading some child porn onto your PC, or it can be, you know,
A literal assassination. Yeah.
it can be up to a little assassination as well. So nobody dares touch them,
Yeah.
right? So how do we get from under this? I think it would take a revolution. But so far, revolutions have been unsuccessful because, you know, through history, they have always been co-opted and controlled by the money-lending oligarchies. You know, when we had the French Revolution in late 1700s, the revolutionaries kept the debts of the aristocracy intact. So they just overthrew the aristocracy in France, and they had the power of the people behind them. And they could have said, okay, the decadent aristocracy that loaded us up with debt, that's theirs. The new French state based on égalité and fraternité and liberté, we have no debts, we owe you nothing to the bankers. But they didn't. They honored the debts in full. Then you had the Bolsheviks.
Yeah.
Same thing. And they also do it selectively, you know, because they'll honor the debts of their sponsors, but they will not honor maybe debts of some private banks that they don't care about. And so I kind of tend to think that maybe the savior is coming from the BRICS camp. Because I know that the Chinese and the Russians have been working extensively on designing a brand new monetary system, something that will be fair and not based on fraud. And I know that Sergei Glazyev, who is one of the longtime close advisors to Vladimir Putin, has been working on this very closely with a team of people. And I know that they have advanced models that I expect that they will implement at some point. But you're going to have to disenfranchise the Western money lending oligarchies, because they are still capable of mobilizing militaries. They're capable of mobilizing the media. They're capable of mobilizing intelligence network assassins and so forth. So this really is that battle that Lord Acton said. The issue that swept down through centuries and that will have to be fought sooner or later is people versus the banks. And I think that that's where we're at, because it's the banks who are holding us in virtual serfdom.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right on that. I would agree with you. I would agree with what you said, but you know, it makes a lot of sense to me because I'm looking at the BRICS, specifically Russia and China. I don't know what their debt levels is, but correct me if I'm wrong. It seems like they're, and I'm going to air quote this, meaning I'm sure there are a lot of things wrong, but they're doing it right, if you would, meaning they're growing, if I'm not mistaken. They're accumulating hard assets, and unless provoked, significantly provoked, they're staying out of people's business. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, yeah, I think that's about correct. And that's, it things could be that way.
Right?
You have w in terms of models of social and economic development, you basically have two prevalent models. And one of them is, you could categorize it as a British model of free trade. And the other one you could categorize as the American system of political economy, right? So one of them is, let's say, more fit to humanity, because what you do is you employ capital at home. So the capital that's generated in a given economy goes reinvested into building infrastructure, into providing loans for small and medium-sized businesses, which are always and everywhere the main engine of economic growth, innovation, and employment. With the growth of industries, people who work there grow prosperous because they get better salaries, and it's in everybody's interest, because if people are prosperous, then there's a ready market to absorb the output of the system. So the whole system has a tendency to kind of grow in terms of economic output, but also in terms of standards of living and prosperity and so forth. And this is what you had in the United States in the 19th century, particularly in the first half of the 19th century. It's called the American system because it was first implemented under guidance by Alexander Hamilton, right? And I think that this is why he unfairly got a very bad rap, because to this day he's being demonized, whereas Andrew Jackson is being lionized. And it's another example of inversion. It should be the opposite. And then this same model was applied in Germany in the second half of the 19th century, and it led to an absolutely spectacular rise of Germany as a new industrial power, to the point that the British felt so threatened by the rise of Germany that they then sought ways to destroy Germany and orchestrated World War I. And then they successfully destroyed Germany. Well, now the same model has been pretty much applied in China over the last 40 years. We can see the results. The same similar model has been applied in Russia. We can see the results. Whereas the West is still closed in this British system of free trade. What does the British system of free trade does? What it does is that it basically, the capital flows freely everywhere and anywhere, and it tends to kind of flow towards countries and economies that offer the cheapest labor force. So it's kind of forcing a race to the bottom. And it is destroying and eroding the standards of living. Because, for countries to be able to attract capital, they have to do away with environmental controls. They have to do away with, social services, job security, building infrastructure. So everything adds to the cost is eliminated. Because the more you strip yourself down to the bare bones, the more profits left for the investors. And then when the investors generate a lot of profit, and this profit usually ends up concentrated in places like New York and London and Paris, well, then they seek new, they don't invest at home. They don't try to industrialize. They don't try to build the infrastructure. That's all wasteful to them. They're seeking for the next place. And if there are no places, they will stage regime changes. They will stage
A
coup.
coup.
They will mobilize army to overthrow governments and invade. And it basically gives rise to colonialism.
Yep, you're
And
absolutely right.
you've never heard of a colony that's been very prosperous and where life is good. It's all miserable. So the British system of free trade is pretty much what gives you misery at home and mayhem abroad. That's what it does, basically. And so basically, that's the choice that any government has. And I know that in the United States, Trump, I believe that he's very sincere, that he wants to change course away from the American system, away from the British system of free trade to the American system of political economy. The test of this is his insistence of ter on tariffs. Tariffs, because if you want to industrialize your nation, if you want to bring jobs, high-paying jobs, you need to protect your market. You need to erect barriers to trade. Because I don't know, if I'm an entrepreneur and I'm going to produce widgets, and it costs me $10 to produce a widget, and then I have to sell it for $12 to make any profit, and then if widgets flood in from China at $5 a piece retail, well, I'm done. I'm not going to have a business. I'm not going to employ anybody. We're just going to be importing widgets from China, and that's going to be that. And where do the jobs come from? From Wall Street and from government, right? That's what it devolves down to.
Yeah, or law. We have so much law now. Everybody wants to be
Oh
an
yeah, there
attorney.
you go. Lawyers, government employees, and Wall Street. And you're always welcome as a cannon fodder. That's always available.
Right. I laugh, but not really. I just laugh at the absurdity of it. So talk about that, then I want to get to the Middle East. But Trump was over in the UK 2 weeks ago, if I'm not mistaken. What do you think that was it about? Was it make was that just a a FaceTime trip, if you would, or is he concerned about what's going on there? Was that Yeah, what was that all about?
Well, that visit was a bit mysterious to me. I don't know what to make of it, but it seems to me that Trump has changed tack a little bit since that visit. Suddenly he started harassing Venezuela and pushing for a regime change there. And he also, out of nowhere, decided that he wants Bagram Base in Afghanistan back. Which is kind of insane, so I don't know what to think of it. I don't. I'm not quite sure what to think of it, except that I know that Bagram Base, generally Afghanistan, was strategically extremely important to the British, because that's one of their footholds from which they can then harass and destabilize Pakistan and India and China, and then they have also a base. For an eastern assault on Iran. And I remember that in 2021, when the United States finally withdrew from Afghanistan, that the British were absolutely hysterical. And you could see the narrative in the United States, the talk was how the withdrawal was bungled, but nobody was really questioning the withdrawal itself. It's been 20 years of nothing but loss of money and treasure and blood. Whereas the Brits were absolutely hysterical for the fact that the United States was withdrawing in the first place. And then, if you remember, they immediately sent some troops there, supposedly on humanitarian missions, but it seems to me that they tried to finagle something to stop the withdrawal or reverse it or see if they can install themselves. But they can't. They barely have any army. And then Venezuela, that's a bizarre one, because
Isn't it?
yeah, it's very bizarre, because you just got your back end handed to you in Afghanistan by the Taliban. You spent 20 years trying to subdue them, and you couldn't, so you had to leave. And then they spent 10 years trying to subdue Ansar Allah in Yemen, and they didn't. And now you're starting a war with, I mean, you're gonna try to orchestrate regime change in Venezuela.
What's the strategic advantage?
No, there's no strategic advantage. Venezuela has the world's largest
Oil.
oil reserves.
Right.
And it's the, you know, like it's the it's the it's the good, well, it's the heavy oil, which is suitable for making diesel and stuff, you know, for
Right.
industrial uses
Yep.
and maritime fuel and jet fuel, which fracked oil isn't. Fracked oil is good for gasoline, and that's about
Yep.
it.
Yep.
And so but it's, you know, you always have the option of buying the oil from the Venezuelan.
Yeah,
That's
right?
always
That's
an
what I was
option,
gonna
you know, and
say.
it's a much, much cheaper option. But the problem, it's the bankers,
Yeah.
okay? It's always the bankers, because if you can regime change Venezuela, then you can, rather than their oil company PDVSA exploiting their oil resources, you can bring in ExxonMobil, you can bring in BP and Shell and all of these companies, right? And then who's going to fund the developments and the trade? It's going to be JP Morgan
Yep.
and Goldman Sachs and Citigroup
Yep.
and, you know, these types. And they're going to secure all those investments with the resource in the ground. So, then on the basis of those resources, you issue loans to your clients, BP, Shell, and all these people. And so now the Venezuelan resources have magically become assets on the balance sheet of New York banks
Yep.
and London banks, probably.
Yep.
And so what do we learn just today? That, what is her name? Gabriela, I think, Machado has been
Yeah.
nominated for Nobel Peace Prize. I don't know if people understand what a joke and what a spit in the face this is to all other recipients of Nobel Peace Prize,
That's why I'm laughing. It's a joke.
because
Go ahead.
she is nothing but an ambitious, power-hungry politician.
Yeah.
That's all she is. She is eager to serve the Western Empire and the financial centers in New York and London. She has been begging the Israelis to intervene in Venezuela. She has been begging the Biden administration to regime change Venezuela. Basically, I see no substantive difference between her and, say, Volodymyr Zelensky or the other guy from 2019, Juan Guaido, right?
Right.
Because remember, there was an attempted regime change in Venezuela in 2003.
Right,
It
right.
failed. Then there was an attempted regime change in Venezuela in 2019.
Yep.
That one didn't go well either. And now it seems that they're trying to do it again. And I don't know if you ever watched the documentary by Aaron Russo, America, Freedom to Fascism. That was way early 2000s. Anyway, Aaron Russo was the producer who made Trading Places with Eddie Murphy.
Yeah, saw
Remember,
that.
that was a phenomenal comedy. It's my very favorite comedy to this day. Aaron Russo became friends with Neil Rockefeller, right? With one of
Interesting.
the scions of the Rockefeller family. And before 9/11 even happened, 9/11 2001, Neil Rockefeller told Aaron Russo that there would be an event in the United States, and after that event, they were going to declare a global war on terror, and it's going to be really cool because it's kind of like it's a war against an amorphous enemy, you know, so you can
Right.
just go wherever, and that they were going to go to Iraq and Afghanistan, and also he said we're also going to go to Venezuela.
Interesting.
So you know, like you understand where the pressure for the regime change is coming from.
Yeah.
Probably also on the pressure on who's going to get the Nobel Peace Prize this year or
Yeah.
any year.
Yeah.
It's the bankers. It's what we're back at that same thing. It's the people versus the bankers, as
As in the French Revolution.
Lord Acton told us we would have to fight. And so it seems to me that the pressure now is also bearing down on Donald Trump. So Donald Trump is now blowing up boats. He sent eight vessels, a submarine, and something like 6,000 troops.
Yeah. To like Puerto Rico, so for easy access, right? Correct me if I'm wrong.
Exactly. But
Which, how are you, what does a submarine have to do with any of
it
that?
can launch. It can launch missiles. Whatever.
Okay.
You can blow
But
up stuff.
yeah,
But
right.
to take control of a country, I think you're not going to get anywhere with 6,000 troops. First of
Right.
all, thumbnail, rule of a thumb, the about half of those are crew. They're
Yeah.
not, they
They're the
stay on the
cooks.
ships. They can't go.
Yeah, they
So you
fix
have
things.
3,000 troops to regime change Venezuela. I mean, that's a joke.
Yeah.
Because and then Venezuela is a it's a tropical country. At best, it could become your next Vietnam,
Right.
you
Yep.
know?
Yep.
And it's not going to help the opposition in Venezuela because it's going to give the government like when the first missile hits anywhere, it's going to give the government a cover to just deal with the opposition quick and swift. It's going to slam them into prisons or eliminate them in whatever way. And I don't know, it to me, I it's the whole thing is so dumb that I suspect that Trump is just making a lot of noise, but without a really sincere intent to actually bring a regime change in Venezuela. That's my suspicion, because otherwise I would have to think that the man is really dumb. And I
Yeah.
know that even that's not, that's debated.
Yeah. Well, I have to agree with what you just said, and I hope that's the case. And I do agree. I just think it's a lot of noise without anything substantial, because it just makes, even just thinking strategically and just thinking like what we just talked about, putting a submarine over there with six, it doesn't make any sense other than it's a great news story. Hey, I'm over here doing something about the drug running or whatever. It just makes absolutely no sense. It's really bizarre to me.
Well, and also if you wanted to really go against drug running, your first line of attack should be the banks, the money laundering banks. That's the first thing. Second, it should be Ecuador, because I think something like 60% of all drugs that go into the United States go
Are
through
from Ecuador.
Ecuador.
Yep.
And the third one should be Canada, because the biggest drug running drug labs that produce fentanyl that then goes into the United States are in Canada.
They're from
And
North,
I've,
yep.
months ago now, at the very beginning, or even before the Trump administration, I watched an interview with one of the FBI investigators, I think, who was laying this out, like, we just busted the biggest, like, industrial scale drug laboratory in I don't know, in Alberta or Saskatchewan, somewhere in Canada, and they did so in cooperation with Canadian police. So the
Yep.
Canadian police actually helped them, and then he explained the whole money laundering dimension. So that tells me that people in the administration actually understand the problem,
Yeah.
which then means that this whole Venezuelan adventure makes a whole lot less sense. It's so dumb. I can't. I have to suspect that that it's a fake fight, that they're just going through the motions, like kind of like, again, the World Wrestling Federation
Yeah, right.
combat without really meaning it. But then if the Norwegians nominate the leader of Venezuelan opposition for Nobel Peace Prize, that tells me that the pressure that's gathering is actually a global scale. Right? Because
Great
the
point.
Nobel Prize Committee is not under Trump's control,
Yeah.
but it will be under, City of London Bank's control and Wall Street Bank's control.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that the pressure been building up for a regime change is probably another globalist boondoggle.
Yeah. So pivot to the Middle East here. So I've had some high profile guests here that have said war is inevitable, not inevitable, but it's likely, but again, giving solutions of why not. But also it just seems there's so much pressure to go into Iran, which absolutely makes no sense. And again, for the record, I am pro peace, pro peace. I am just pretty much against all war now. And when I say now, always have been really, just because of everything. But there's so much pressure to go into Iran. And then it comes out that there's peace, or there's Palestinian peace with Israel after Palestine's been completely leveled. I guess, what do you see now happening with Iran? I mean, do you see that as do you see that pressure continuing to build, and then a war happens? And where does Russia fit into all this? Because it seems like Russia is going to arm Iran if this happens, which is also crazy.
Well, it's not just if this happens. Russia and China have been the shipping new weapon systems to Iran.
Right.
And Iran also has extremely impressive weapon systems themselves. It's a very bizarre thing because I've seen, I've been paying attention to what people have been saying about this peace that was announced 2 days ago. So what are we, 10 October now? Trump announced the peace deal on the 8th October. Yesterday, the IDF withdrawal was supposed to commence, and apparently it did commence, apart from a couple of tank shells that they fired into the crowd of Palestinian civilians and killed about 53 of them. But apparently, everybody agreed to peace. Even the Israeli cabinet agreed to peace. Okay, Smotrich came out yesterday and said, like, no, as soon as we have all the hostages back, we're going to go back to, bombing Gaza, basically. He didn't say exactly those words, but that's exactly what he meant. But it seems that, Trump has somehow brought on board all of the regional powers and a number of important Muslim countries like Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, Turkey, Lebanon, Qatar. Who else? Oh yeah, Indonesia. Indonesia is not in the region, but they are an important Muslim country in the
Muslim
world.
country, yeah.
And everybody's supporting the deal. The 800-pound gorilla in the region is not on board, which is Iran. Probably because nobody asked them.
Right.
But in the meantime, also news yesterday, Vladimir Putin has apparently stated that, and this is confirmed, that Israel is no longer interested in going to war against Iran, and they've requested that Moscow convey that message to the Iranian leadership and that they serve as a mediator between. So that's just, you'd think like that's about as spectacular as things get.
Yeah.
And well, what does it mean? That means that the Netanyahu's coalition is going to splinter. But
Yes.
then, there's also the leader of Israeli opposition, like Lapid Yair Lapid, yeah. He said that he would back Netanyahu and that there's any votes in the Knesset that could jeopardize his position, that they're going to provide him like a safety net. So it appears that if all of this is true and all of this sticks together, it seems that they found a formula to get Netanyahu on board. Netanyahu, at least apparently, is on board. Smotrich and Ben-Gvir are not, but let's see. And apparently Hamas is also on board. And now, this all has to happen relatively quickly. I think that it's within the 14th of October, so another 4 days. IDF has to withdraw, and Hamas has to return all the hostages, dead and alive. I think there's about 48 of them. I think that two at least went over today. And then there's I think 20 are alive and the rest are probably dead. But then we'll see what happens after that, because if the peace holds and Netanyahu stays in power and the war against Iran doesn't happen, because that's what the whole peace deal should be, that should be part of the whole peace deal. Well, then I think that Trump actually delivered like a devastating blow to the globalist empire, because Israel has been probably their high priority beachhead in the Middle East to keep control of the region, and their top priority has been to regime change Iran. Well, if they don't go to war against Iran, if Israel doesn't go to war against Iran, then the United States has no reason to go to war against Iran. And then maybe that war really isn't going to happen. Well, if it did happen, it would be absolutely suicidal for the Iranians. It would be devastating for the United States. And I think that even if they used nuclear weapons against Iran, that they wouldn't, that's still not a guarantee that they would succeed. And then there's a complication with Pakistan. Pakistan does have nuclear weapons, and then they said, if Israel uses nuclear weapons against Iran, we are going to use a nuclear weapon against Israel. So it's like a whole mega mess. But let's say that if what Trump announced 2 days ago is implemented, and we'll know in another couple of days, and if it holds, if the crazies in Tel Aviv, like Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich, if they're disenfranchised and sidelined somehow, and the war against Iran doesn't happen, well, that's actually a very spectacular development. And I, as many of these geopolitical experts that I've been able to listen in the last few days about this, the opinions have gone all over the place, because nobody's sure what's going on. Nobody's sure, can Hamas be trusted? Can Israel be trusted? Can Trump be trusted? But all this apparently happened. And in spite of the attack on Israeli Hamas negotiators in Qatar, they did hold negotiations in Egypt, in Cairo. So, we might be on the verge of something really important, which actually may deserve a peace prize. But the Nobel Prize Committee is doesn't respond to actual peace. They respond to agendas.
So let's assume, and this is very, I agree with you that this is very earth-shattering important if this were to happen. Really, and we'll end on this. What happens then to Netanyahu?
Well, it seems to
He
me
needs
that it
war,
de
right?
well, he needs war, except, and I don't understand how the plumbing is laid out in Israel, but I just read that the leader of the opposition, Yair Lapid, has said that his party would support Netanyahu in case his coalition splinters, in case there are votes in the Knesset to indict Netanyahu, whatever. So it seems to me that as part of this deal, they've also kind of contrived an insurance policy for him. So maybe he actually gets to walk away into the sunset eventually, which is like a vomit-inducing thought. But if it makes the killing of the Palestinians stop, then
I'm all for it. I'm all for it. If it makes the
Whatever. Yeah,
planes faster.
exactly. I'm for it. I'm for it. And he'll get his due punishment in the next life. He's gonna burn in hell. He's gonna burn in the mixture of excrement and what is it? I forget. Because there's like a special formula where apparently Jesus is burning according to that tribe, and I forget what it is, but I know that excrement is part of it.
Well, I can wish that. I can wish that as well. So, well, we're going to end on that. I know you got to go, but before all that, just to all my viewers and listeners, Alex is one of the great guys, one of the good guys. I am also a very happy and proud supporter of your trading Substack. So please check that out. And Alex, I want you to give not only you're great at geopolitics, but also as a trader, please give out your Substacks so people can read more what you have to offer and how they can read about your trading strategies.
Yeah, well, so I started into all this as a trader, except that at some point I realized that if we end up burned to a crisp in a nuclear holocaust, then all the trading and investing doesn't really amount to anything. But that's my day job, and that's been my career for a very long time. And
I
so
first
today I
talked to you as a
published.
trader. Go ahead, go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. So I published a daily market newsletter that provides trend following signals for a set of 18 global markets, things like S&P 500, Nasdaq, Nikkei, DAX, FTSE, American, British, Japanese bonds, gold, Bitcoin, things like that. And so that goes out 5 days a week, every day. Then I have, and it's called iSystem Trend Following. And then I also publish a personal Substack where I publish things not quite so often, but more
More like this.
things more like this, yeah, things to do with history and geopolitics and such and thusly. And then I'm quite active on X. My handle is at Naked Hedgy, and from there people can find my other platforms. But basically, these are three where I'm most active.
Well, thank you. And again, to all my viewers and listeners, I am a very proud and happy supporter of Alex on his Trading Signal Substack. Alex, you got to run. I want to thank you. You always make time for me. And I'm very, very grateful to that. I'm very grateful. So thank you for that. I want to have you on again soon as hopefully when things are de-escalating, not escalating.
Excellent. It was always good to join you, Andy. Warm greetings to your viewers and listeners, and good weekend to everybody. Let's hope that Trump's peace holds. And I think if there's one thing worth praying for, this one is it for the weekend.
Thank you. Well said. All right.
Take
Have a
care.
great weekend, my friend.
Yep, you too.